Good afternoon. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. And I think what we'll do is we'll kick off with the... maybe we're blasting into space. I don't know. Or the tea is ready. We'll start by going back to the testimony we weren't able to finish up on the last bill we were considering, Representative Creech's bill. The ABC Act yesterday. So I know Mr. Uni with the department is here, and I think maybe the other names I had on the list were Diane Halsey, Voices and Choices for Children, and Wendy Webster. Welcome. And if each of you would please just state your name for the record before providing your remarks. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Adosh Uni, and I am Government Relations Director with the Department of Education. Thanks for the opportunity to briefly testify today on Representative Creech's bill on early learning scholarships. As you know, the governor supports early learning in the state of Minnesota, but also approves of early learning pathways, especially in school districts. And so the department would like to raise some concerns with the Amendment 4 to the Representative Creech's bill, which essentially removes key portions of Pathway 2, which reduces the access for 3 and 4 star rated programs. Those are districts, centers, Head Start, and soon in the future we'll have some family care providers that have expressed interest in applying, so this isn't just limited to there. But the real issue is funding for capacity building. Getting rid of Pathway 2 would disallow these programs who are 3 and 4 star rated to enhance their services. This is crucial for providing children in these programs with the highest quality of programming. Also, getting rid of the direct payments would result in less available scholarships. Direct payments allow us to reduce administrative costs. From fiscal 14, where we had about 8% in administrative costs having to go through regional administrators, by fiscal 17, we project to reduce that to 4.5%, not having to use the regional administrators. Not having Pathway 2 for 3 and 4 star rated programs also reduces access where there may be where the school district or the Head Start or centers that are 3 or 4 star rated may be the only sources available. Having direct payments under the Pathway 2 also means fewer people handling private child data, and so getting rid of that would compromise our efforts to strengthen data security. Additionally, we would oppose holding districts and Head Starts at fiscal 17 levels. Again, as I mentioned, that would be limiting the capacity building that we feel is crucial to providing the highest quality services to children that are in these programs. And kind of attached to that, too, we'd oppose moving the scholarship funds in and out of recipient providers under Pathway 2 through the system called the Early Learning Scholarship Administrative System that was put into place last year. We're able to allow Pathway 2 providers the flexibility when there's funding available to shift the funds out of their programs to either regional administrators, which would allow for usage in Pathway 1, or to other Pathway 2 providers. So there is some flexibility in the funding that goes to Pathway 2 providers right now. We do anticipate the 3 and 4 star rated programs that are eligible for Pathway 2 to increase in the areas of center-based providers and family care providers. Just wanted to make sure that the members understood that. On the underlying bill, we would just briefly say that the definition for tracking homelessness might be a little bit expansive. It's looking back at families who have been homeless at any point in the past 2 years. Districts, when they're looking at their homelessness rates, are looking under the McKinney-Vento definition, and that doesn't expand back to 2 years, so we may have some difficulty in tracking that. So we would love to work with the author to get a definition that I think works with what districts are tracking right now and what the department is capable of. And with that, I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Uni. The recent report on the scholarship program that MDE presented to us indicated that children of greater need, higher risk, greater opportunity, if however you want to think about it, were generally found in the pathway 2 area. And so I just need to check. It seems to me that if our goal is to have the greatest impact on children of the greatest need, where the greatest potential turnaround in their lives and return on taxpayers' dollars exists, that blocking further funding of Pathway 2's dollars goes about 180 degrees against meeting the needs of those kids. Am I putting together the language in this bill and the language of that report correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I can't speak to the exact numbers, but yes, the Pathway 2 scholarships allow for this building of capacity at these institutions that are able to serve more students and serve a lot of these students who are higher at risk, especially at our community schools and our Head Start organizations that are built to serve students who are underrepresented and low income. So we do believe that restricting Pathway 2s would negatively impact the purpose of what this scholarship program is, and that's to serve our most at-risk students.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Rooney, having had children in private family daycare when my kids were younger, and understanding then what the services that you get there, that the child accesses there, and then when I contrast it with what I understand and have seen both in Head Start, where it's a more comprehensive whole child approach and can include medical services, dental services, eye services, active engagement of the family, things like that, and in the public schools where a child in a preschool program would have access to social workers, school counselor, school nurse, that in both those cases the Pathway 2 dollars provide a richer basket of services for the child who needs them than on, in general, a Pathway 1 private family child care provider would do. Am I understanding Pathway 2 service providers correctly?
Yes, I would say that these institutions on whole have access and generally provide richer services as they are connected, especially at the school-based, are connected with more comprehensive spectrum of services. And that's one of the purposes of school districts participating in this program, is that they provide access for these families to a whole list of services that are provided for families in the K-12 spectrum. And that includes many of the items that you brought up, Representative Dabney, in terms of social workers and such, and health services as well.
One last question, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. Thank you. I know Minneapolis, last I heard, has somewhere between 350 and 400 preschoolers on its waiting list for its preschool program. These are families that have chosen a Pathway 2 approach, have chosen a public approach, and aren't being served. If the language in this bill blocking funding of Pathway 2s going forward were to go into law, wouldn't we anticipate that that undermines family choice when they are actively wanting to use a program that's located either Head Start or at their public school? Aren't we interfering with parental choice here?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, the Pathway 2s allow these districts to build up a large amount of available spots, which allows parents to enter these programs. So restricting that, and the other provision where it restricts the Pathway 2 recipient providers at their fiscal year 17 will restrict their ability to build out those spots and capacity in the future. And I can't say for sure, but what I project that would possibly make it more difficult for parents and students to enter those programs in the future.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony. All right.
Good afternoon, Chair Loon, members of the Education Finance Committee. My name is Wendy Webster. I'm the Director of Community Services for St. Anthony Brighton School District. I'm here on behalf of not only our 3 and 4-year-old learners in our school district, but also throughout Minnesota. Pathway 2 scholarships have allowed increased participation children with high needs in high-quality, four-star rated, school-based, and Head Start programs throughout our state. And as detailed in the Minnesota Department of Education's evaluation report of the Early Learning Scholarship Program, 59% of children are actually served and receive a Pathway to Scholarship, and 95% of parents who enrolled their child in a program of their choice, including school-based programs. So parents are choosing school-based programs, and they qualify for a Pathway to Scholarship. Pathway to Scholarships allow school districts flexibility to meet the various needs of parents and families in their community, to expand or enhance early childhood programs based on the specific needs of those families. For example, Pathway to Scholarships allow parents to choose our high-quality school-based programs and also funds program enhancements to eliminate waiting lists, provide transportation, and implement an additional section of early learning classes to serve more children. These funds allow us to serve children with high needs in our program and increase the number of classroom staff to support the children. Eliminating program enhancements would impact local control, as school districts would not have the critical funds to hire nursing or additional staff when our programs enroll more children with special needs. Program enhancements are an investment in our families. They allow high-quality programs to increase the number of students served, and specifically students with the highest needs and barriers to achieving success in kindergarten. According to the evaluation report, Pathway to school-based and Head Start providers are serving the most racially and ethnically diverse students and the vast majority of our English language learners in our state. The evaluation report certainly confirmed our experience as school districts. First, parents are choosing Pathway to programs, and these programs are meeting the diverse needs of our most at-risk families. With Pathway to funds, our program in St. Anthony was able to lease a van and, for the first time, transport children to preschool. Of the students receiving a Pathway to scholarship, 25% are enrolled in a full-day program, and 75% are enrolled in a half-day program and provided transportation. Second, Pathway to programs are serving a highly diverse population. Of our students receiving a Pathway to scholarship in St. Anthony, 88% are students of color, and 50% of students are learning English. Third, Pathway to programs are serving the highest need children. In St. Anthony, one tool we use to assess all incoming preschool students is the Minnesota Executive Functioning Scale, which ranges from a score of 1, which is low, to 7, which is high. Executive Functioning Skills, which many of you are familiar with, are the foundational self-regulatory skills that are involved in controlling one's intention, thoughts, actions, and emotions. And these skills are critical to learning and problem solving. So again, 1 is low, 7 is high. Of our students receiving a Pathway to scholarship, in the fall, 38% scored a 1, 38% scored a 3, and 25% scored a 4. When you compare the same, our preschool student population as a whole, 19% of students scored a 1, 7% of students scored a 3, and 45% of students scored a 4. As you discuss House Bill 2670, please understand that curtailing resources for Pathway to programs would not be in the best interest of reaching and serving families across our state. Thank you for your time and commitment to our youngest learners in Minnesota. And at this time, I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Is Diane Halsey here? Please come on up to the testifier table. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Geraldine. I'm Diane Halsey. I am the Director of Family Engagement at Think Small. I'm also here as the co-chair of the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Amendment 2 for this, for House File 2670. The reason why I'm here is to talk about the importance of us tracking data on race and ethnicity for providers. One of the main purposes of even having this scholarship program and us focusing on children that are may not have the means to provide for their preschool education. It's our hope that we're closing the achievement gap. And in order for us to really know if we are achieving this goal, we need to have data that disaggregates for race. The main reason why we hesitate to report on some of this data for providers is because we don't really have something that defines how to what is a provider of color, especially when you're talking about center-based care. And this amendment actually provides us a definition and a way for us to track that data. The reason why you may be asking why it's important for us to track data on providers of color, many parents of color in Minnesota, myself included, believe it is really important for the person that is providing the care for their youngest learner to reflect the ethnic, cultural background, and even the language of the home. It is believed that this helps to increase the self-esteem of that child and the ego strength. In other words, we are more confident that these providers will believe our children can succeed and learn. And allowing us to track this data helps us to show our progress in this area. In addition to that, at Think Small, we also administer the scholarships for Region 11 and Region 3. And we are often requested information on this data, on what providers of color we have. We may have a little bit of data on that for family child care, but we don't have it for center-based. And this amendment would actually allow us to provide all of that data that we would for the public.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Crescia had a question.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Is it Halsey?
Halsey, thank you.
Halsey. So I wanted to clear this up. We had a little bit of confusion yesterday with everything that was going on. The amendment you're speaking to and what you're doing is a great idea. And I've talked to both Representative Mariani and Representative Flanagan that we'd like to do this and we'd like to do it right. And so the agreement that we talked about yesterday was I will work with Representative Flanagan, Representative Mariani, and we'll work with Head Start, MDE, and Head Start, MDE, and who's the other one? Oh, Parent Aware. And we'll make sure that we get this together and consistent and we do it right so we just don't do a piecemeal approach. But I think this is a great idea and I'd like to move forward with it. I just want to do it in a way that everybody can agree to it and get the right data so we're looking at apples to apples, if that works for you.
Understandable. Chair Loon, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your testimony and thank you for everyone for making the travel back today so we could finish up testimony we weren't able to get to yesterday. So with that, we're going to start on the bills on the schedule for today. And the first up I have is House Bill 3273, if Representative Moran and her testifiers are ready. Right, welcome, and Representative Moran, I will go ahead and move your bill, House File 3273, be referred to Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. And with that, you are recognized, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So often, we have, within our education committees, we've talked about educational outcomes, working to close the achievement gap, but also we talk a lot about cultural competency. And so before us, there's a bill that really, I believe, works towards that end in really bringing, educating teachers and students around cultural competence and what that looks like. And so I will stop there because I have a testifier here who has a concept that's very innovative, very creative, and work towards that end that will allow to speak about the bill.
Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, my name is Benjamin Mackay. I'm the founder and executive director of African American Registry and the creator of the Teachers Forum subscription service. I thank all of you for your attention this afternoon. Our service is aligned with HF 3273. Our organization was founded in 2000, and the Teachers Forum will be 5 years old this September. My goal this afternoon is to further substantiate our growth into higher education through the Q program. Through a timeline, everyone who hears me will be visiting self-esteem, we'll be visiting achievement gaps, and we will be visiting how constituency and diversity beckons improving Minnesota's education through our work. In 2006, the registry presented to outstate teachers at the Minnesota Humanities Center. This was to address the growing diversity in rural Minnesota through education. Afterwards, a teacher from Bemidji complimented our presentation but said that he would never use our material because he had only one black student in his class. In 2014, I attended a presentation about the achievement gap. To add to their point about how they were lifting the self-esteem of at-risk youth, they showed an image of a boy that could have been me 55 years ago. Last December, before presenting at a subject area lead teacher meeting at a school we're servicing, middle years program coordinators explained to me that many of their staff were apprehensive about using diverse curriculum for fear of making a mistake. What's the connection here? When addressing lack of self-esteem in K-12, too many of us limit our models or cases to non-white students. I would submit to this committee that regarding cultural competence, any unprepared teacher's self-esteem is challenged as well, and this can contribute to one's apprehension to teach better. The Teachers Forum service tool includes lesson plans, media, articles that translate into 52 languages, career references, discussion boards, monthly updates, coaching, and much, much more. Implicit bias is an unfortunate reality of many Minnesota teachers. Responsibility is not solely the messenger, the teacher. It is also the message, the curriculum. At the registry, our Teachers Forum revitalizes licensed staff with culturally competent curriculum. We build units, staff and parent rapport, staff and student rapport. We also increase attendance and graduation with safer classrooms and renew the love to be educated. Preparing students in higher education before employment removes that unlearning piece. It makes fiscal sense to groom pre-service teachers with pedagogy and method to lead a class with a curriculum that fits. Our online accessibility matches the IT world of tomorrow's teachers as well as adding to professional employment stability. I was combing through my emails this morning and I ran across this email from October 2015. Hello, my name is Carrie Armgost. I am a student at Little Falls High School in Minnesota. I am doing a research project on African Americans in the National Football League. I came across your article, Black Contributions to American Professional Football Are Many, and I'm going to use the information from this article to make a presentation. I would like to know more about who authored the article. I am waiting for a prompt response. Q graduates will work anywhere in Minnesota, and the Browning of our beloved state is here. To discuss diversity, census of 2000 to 2010, the numbers that I researched show Princeton, Minnesota up 2%, Lakeville up 5%, Little Falls up 1%, Eden Prairie up 9%, Greenfield, Minnesota up 1%, Fergus Falls up 2%, Starbuck up 2%, and Apple Valley up 8%. African American Registry's Teachers Forum would enjoy a full demonstration of our service to this committee in the future. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, and your committee for your attention to our work.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. Welcome. Thank you. My turn. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Lisa Tabor. I'm founder of Culture Brokers, a consulting agency specializing in results-based organizational inclusion. I am here for as a friend to Representative Moran and as a client to Ben Mackay, the African American Registry, as a diversity and inclusion professional, and as a concerned citizen to encourage you to support House File 3273, a bill that includes instruction about African Americans in programs funded by the Collaborative Urban Educator Grant. For more than 10 years, I have helped all types of organizations improve outcomes for racially and culturally diverse employees and customers. This shared success is the result of a particular kind of approach, that when one finds the bulk of people experiencing a certain outcome, the problem is not with the people, the problem is with the process. As I consider the significant racial and cultural disparities in key performance indicators in Minnesota's education system, I can't help but take that approach of the process is the problem. So when I see prolific and persistent failures of Minnesota's education system to adequately prepare a significant population of children for thriving futures, I know that something's wrong with the process. Minnesota leaders actually often take that view as well. And when they do, they have measurable successes. Cue up this program that we're talking about here, the Collaborative Urban Educator Grant, which was established to address one critical problem in the process, the Minnesota Teacher Licensure Pipeline. In 2015, Concordia, St. Thomas, and Hamline University reported that since that grant's inception, they had trained, placed, and retained hundreds of teachers of color who would not otherwise have had the opportunity to become licensed professionals and teach in Minnesota's schools. Clearly, this change in the historical process has been a success. You have the opportunity to magnify that success now by making another strategic change to Minnesota's educational system. House File 3273 adjusts the traditional process of teacher training by ensuring these new teachers have the information and understanding they need to perform effectively with a student body growing more diverse every year. Including instruction about African American history, culture, and heritage in Q teacher training is a low-risk, high-reward change that can help new teachers adequately prepare a significant population of children for thriving futures. Therefore, I urge you to support House File 3273.
Thank you, Ms. Tabor. Okay, and I think I don't have any questions right now. I do see some other testifiers or people indicated they wanted to testify. Ms. Nasagi and Paul Spies. And then Christopher Fleming. So, want to come down? All right, while they're coming down, Representative Quam, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, you know, reading through the language of the bill, I don't see anything for Latino or American Indian or any of the other cultures of color in the bill. And there are parts of the state where there's a real need for that. So I'm just trying to understand why they were left out of the bill.
Representative Moran?
For the purpose of, in regards to cultural competency within the African American community that has been disproportionately impacted within our community educational system, we feel that this will be not only helpful and supportive to African American children, but also to non-teachers of color who are engaging with that population of kids. And maybe Ben, you'd like to expand on that?
Mr. Mackay.
Sir, could you repeat the question, please?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the question I was wondering is why Latino, American Indian, and other cultures of color weren't included, because if you're doing a bill to try and it's the process, and by including, you know, that broader understanding, I think might be, you know, advantageous That way we don't have to come back and readdress. If we're going to establish, we might as well establish something that is broad and inclusive and comprehensive.
I agree 100%. And to that end, what the registry has done is we've installed a translation piece in our articles that translates into 52 languages. And those languages cover Japanese, they cover Spanish, they cover 52 languages. We also have made it a point to tell the most honest story of the African-American experience, certainly for the state of Minnesota, and perhaps for the country. What I'm trying to say is that you can't really tell a factually honest story of the African-American experience. That means descendants of slaves, people who arrived before the Mayflower, without including the Asian community, without including the Native community, without including the Latino community, without including the European white community. Example, our site is chronologically structured, so it changes every day on our homepage to reflect the current date in our story. 146 years ago today, the first Voting Rights Act was passed in 1870. Okay? And below that article, which again can translate into 52 different languages, there are two personal narratives to complement the text. One of those comes from a white man named Kevin Mahila. Kevin works for the Minnesota Historical Society. We did a piece with him out at Fort Snelling where he talks about the Dred Scott decision and how it impacted the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and led to a turning point that led to the Civil War. Below him, we have Dr. Judith Richardson, who talks about the right to vote and how important it is today. We have a number of Latino people in our personal narratives. We have a number of Asian people in our personal narratives. We are in conversation with Clyde Belcourt to have more Native Americans embedded into our narratives to support the Black Seminole connection and a number of other, shall we say, factual indexes that include those other races and colors that you speak of that are so important.
Thank you. All right, so I hope I'm pronouncing this. Misagi?
Yes. Well, Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Nanette Misagi, and I'm the director of the Collaborative Urban Educator Program at the University of St. Thomas. We are one of four institutions that currently receive funding through the Collaborative Urban Educator, or Q, grant program from the state of Minnesota. We are grateful to Representative Moran for bringing this bill forward and for considering ways to increase the ability of our programs to educate and train teachers of color. St. Thomas's Collaborative Urban Educator program was a pioneer in increasing the diversity of Minnesota's teachers. We have been specifically focusing on training teachers of color for more than 20 years, a proven track record. I'm here today also speaking on behalf of Concordia University, St. Paul, and Hamline University. Together, our three institutions have pioneered minority teaching training programs in the state of Minnesota. Our three programs have relied on resources committed by our own universities, funding from private foundations, and the state's Q grant program. The grant funding through the state has been essential to our ongoing success, and we are grateful that the legislature is considering additional investments. We do not have any concerns with incorporating curriculum on African American history. I've actually used the African American registry previously. Culture and heritage, as Representative Moran's bill would require. In fact, our programs are already providing some level of instruction in this area. We're happy to work with Representative Moran and the legislature to ensure that our programs are meeting the high standards in preparing and educating our teachers of color. And we appreciate Representative Erickson for providing for the possibility of an increase in funding this grant program in her bill, House File 3132, Section 7, which you'll hear later on your agenda today. For more than 20 years, we have been the state's only consistent partners in pursuing its longstanding policy to encourage the recruitment, training, placement, and retention of more teachers of color. We are glad to see increased interest among more organizations in solving the massive disparity between teachers of color and students of color. As programs with significant experience in this work, we stand ready to do more ourselves and share our expertise with others. Each of our institutions currently receives $195,000 per year in Q grant funding. With additional funding, our schools would be able to expand mentoring programs specifically for Black and Hispanic male teachers' perspectives, creating stronger partnerships with Minnesota K-12 schools to prepare students to pursue a career in teaching and further develop a teacher workforce pipeline. Work within districts to aid in the transition and cultural growth of a diverse teaching staff, culturally responsive teaching, and conduct a statewide study of higher education institutions and K-12 districts to determine potential expansion of the Q program outside the Twin Cities. Again, thank you to Representative Moran for this bill, and also to Representative Erickson for the bill she will present later in this hearing, and to all of you for your interest in our programs and your commitment to increase the number of teachers of color in Minnesota and have them be properly prepared. I would be happy to answer any of the questions that you might have.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, so Mr. Spies and Mr. Fleming.
So, Madam Chair, Chris Fleming, F-L-E-M-I-N-G with one M. I'd like to speak in support of the bill, House File 3273. I work in Minneapolis Public Schools as the Black Male Achievement Coordinator at Patrick Henry High School, North Minneapolis. I'm also a master's student at St. Thomas in Policy and Law, and I have close friends who are in the Q program right now at St. Thomas. I really wanted to just bring my support to this bill. As the Black Male Achievement Coordinator at Patrick Henry, I am always teaching cultural competency to the teachers there. That is one part of my twofold job, is to make sure that our teachers know about racial equity and cultural competency, that they know about African American history to better support our Black males and Black females at the school. Knowing that this bill would be passing and going to St. Thomas and the Q program and all the other programs across the metro who do require our teachers to teach in Minneapolis public schools for at least 2 or 3 years, this would be very beneficial to making sure that our teachers are competent. The teachers know how to work with those populations in their schools. Studies have shown, and you can look at studies from California, Arizona, that after studies and teachers being culturally competent is beneficial to all students, not just African Americans, not just Latino Chicanos, indigenous students, but white students as well. So it's important that our teachers know the information that is going to be taught by the African American Registry or anyone who is teaching African American history from the perspective of Black people and not from the perspective of those who think they know the history. So I ask that you support this bill and use this bill as a form of liberation for our students and teachers and not as a form of controlling a narrative. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is Mr. Spies? Want to come down?
Hi, my name is Paul Spies. I'm a professor in the Urban Teacher Program at Metropolitan State University, and just wanted to say this bill is very important, not only for the Q institutions, but hopefully down the road for other institutions and programs throughout the state. It's needed very much. The curriculum in our schools needs to be enhanced even more, and very supportive of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spies. I apologize for mispronouncing your name. All right, any questions? Representative Moran, or Mariani, excuse me.
It's quite an honor to be called Representative Moran, believe me. Well, a couple of things. I have a question, I think, primarily for, I forget your name, you're with the St. Thomas program.
Ms. Masagi,
I apologize. I should know that. But before I do, let me just quickly say, I think the Representative Quam's question, and it's not a bad question, I think part of the answer here is that there are practices and knowledges that come from within the African American experience that have a lot to teach us in our society, and not just teaching white folks, but also teaching lots of everyone else in our society, that there's a valuable narrative, set of experiences, practices there that really do cut across, in my opinion, all cultural, racial experiences, and have a lot to say about how we engage with one another in a powerful citizenship building way. I think there are many doors through which we can come in to this conversation, and I think it's an exciting and rich possibility to walk through all of them, but absolutely to walk through an African-American perspective. So having said that, I just have a couple questions about the Q program in general. One is, and maybe the department is best to answer this, but the one is, how do we know how well the Q programs are doing? Are they evaluated on a regular basis? Who does the evaluation, and what do we generally know about that evaluation without going too much in depth, because we have a lot of bills here, but I just want to get a sense of, you know, a sense of confidence for all of us that, you know, we have confidently invested in these programs, but how do we objectively know how good they are or you know, how good they are?
That's a very good point. I'm new to the director position as of July 1, so I've done a lot of research around that and found that there really isn't a reporting mechanism around an assessment, but there is a reporting mechanism that's required. Each Q institution has to every year report to MDE about how are you spending the money, and report how many teacher candidates of color that you are producing. So for myself, I've done my own personal analysis, you know, how many are passing MTLE, how many teachers of color have completed the program, because there's difference between completing a program and then getting your license. And then, of course, how many go on to master's program. So I have all of that data, which I will be supplying to the MDE group this June. So with that being said, so I can just report, and I don't know if you want to hear how specifically, like how St. Thomas is doing, like because I do have a little report here.
Ms. Sagi, I don't want to monopolize the time. I know we have lots of, and that's probably rich information.
Yes.
But I'm thinking it's going to eat up a lot of our time,
yes.
And perhaps
so we'll
find a time to come back.
Each university, we have really rich data to say we've got almost 1,000 people working in school districts over the past 25 years.
Madam Chair. And Ms. Masagi, so this is some important data that's being reported out, and there's a process by which that happens. I think, Madam Chair, as we dive deeper into this issue, we spent quite a bit of time, Representative Erickson's committee the other day, talking through the depth of both the opportunities but also the challenges that our state has in terms of diversifying our teaching corps. I mean, quite frankly, we haven't done it in 20, 30 years. You know, we've been pretty much stuck, you know, at the 4% teacher of color percentage of all our teachers. It's 3%. Even as our students of color population has grown from 10% during that period of time to right around 30%. And so there's a real big question before all of us about do we want to continue with a dominant design that basically says we're confident that a non-diverse teaching corps can accomplish the goals that we've set for our students against state standards as that student body continues to diversify. So all that by way of saying, I think that one of the things I would encourage us to do, whether we can do it this year or not, I think this investment is a good investment. I think we need to modernize our assessment and our evaluation of the investments that we have made. Maybe there's further data that we need to get out. One of the data areas I'm most concerned with is long-term retention of your candidates, because my sense is we're not able to hang on to those folks for long periods of time. So let me just end by asking a quick question of you, Ms. Masagi. Three good programs producing good outcomes, but we have a bigger fish to fry than three small programs can accomplish in this state, I think. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what are your thoughts about how these three programs can play a bigger role in informing the rest of our infrastructure in our state in terms of producing more effective and diverse teachers of color?
That's a really great question. There is a great body of knowledge and best practice, because you just couldn't have a university to say, okay, we're going to start this program like 2 months from now and expect you're going to have great results. So there has to be capacity building, there has to be a structure. And so certainly we've had conversations amongst our universities to say, how could we reach out? And we have put had consultations about how could we maybe do a feasibility study based on the MDE supply and demand report. You know, we know across the state we have all these regional areas that have terrible crises. I mean, we are in a shortage. We're in a crisis. So we could be doing some kind of study this next year to see, okay, what... go deeper and to say what are the needs, what are the capacities in these different areas, and how could different universities tie in and create more avenues to have more teachers of color produced in those areas that could teach and student teach, because there's a lot of issues. There's just not a lot of places for people to do their student teaching. So there's a lot of structural things that need to be put into place. So certainly our universities are poised and have a great tradition and success rate to be able to help, and so we're totally open to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani.
Representative Moran.
So when I look at what the African American Registry does, I think it's, in my opinion, really goes beyond the urban initiative in training teachers of color. I think if we can get this to be a part of any teacher program, whether it's at the U of M in Duluth, any program, so because it's a belief that teachers want to be effective, right? I believe teachers want to be effective with all students, right? And so, but teachers need greater knowledge of, they need training around and experience with world culture. And this is a way of implementing that and getting teachers who are born into that field better prepared to interact with a very much diverse population of students. So, although we're looking at the urban initiative, I think this is really how do we prepare all teachers.
Thank you. And Representative Moran, I know you are needed in Transportation Committee. So I have two other members on the list with questions, and I'll ask you each, is it a question of Representative Moran or of one of the testifiers? Representative Erickson? No? You're okay? Representative Slocum?
You know what? I don't need to ask it back.
Very well. Good. So with that, this is deadline week, so for everyone wondering what's going on, it's very busy. All right, so if the members who were on the list do not need to ask any questions, I think we can probably wrap up. I know it's a meaty topic, and I'm glad that Education, Innovation, and Policy has been digging into this as well. So, but we appreciate very much all of your testifiers, Representative Moran, and the idea you brought to us today. Any final quick thoughts before I move your bill?
So I just want to raise this up and say, please take a look at this document that should be in your folder there, and take some time just digesting what the power of what this initiative can do in regards to teachers. And thank you again, Madam Chair, for allowing this bill to come before this committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Moran. And with that, I would renew my motion that House File 3273 be referred to Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Your bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Moran. All right. And Representative Pearson, let's move you in. House File 3233, is that the correct bill number? Yes.
I hope so.
Okay. Very well. Representative Pearson, I would move that House File 3233 be re-referred to Ways and Means, but today the chair's intention is to lay it over, and you are recognized. Please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing this bill. Like you just mentioned, it is deadline week, and we're hoping that this can be considered for possible inclusion. I think it's officially the shortest bill I've presented, so if you glance at it quickly, you should be able to read through it. In short order, the main goal is to get some tuition reimbursement for teachers that are taking on the role of teaching concurrent enrollment classes in the school systems. And this is important. Again, as we talk about affordable education, especially higher ed and whatnot, I think access to some of these classes is going to be vital. I also think that making sure we have an adequate number of well-trained teachers to teach those classes, to allow those students to get concurrent enrollment, is going to be vital as well. I don't think I have any testifiers, so I'll let the bill stand on its merits and answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Any questions? Oh, Representative Selznick.
Well, thank you, and thank you for bringing this forward. This is very important legislation, Representative Pearson. I'm just wondering why you picked 18 graduate credits. Is that what they need, or I was just wondering about the number.
I think it's a starting point, and I believe that again, the goal is to at least get some support and some assistance for a lot of teachers rather than fully fund the entire process.
Right. And Representative Seltzer, 18 credits in your field is what the Higher Learning Commission is requiring for being able to conduct concurrent enrollment classes. Other questions? All right. Yeah, it is. I think it is one of the shortest bills we've had before this committee. Representative Pearson, thank you. With that, I would renew my motion that the bill House File 3233 be referred to Ways and Means, but today the chair's intention is to lay it over. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, Representative Nornes, looks like you're here and ready to go, so we'll call you up for House File 3326. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wish I could say that this will be the shortest bill, maybe the second shortest. But we have two testifiers today have traveled from Fergus Falls and around and further, right?
Yes.
To be here. This also is dealing with concurrent enrollment. House File 3326 kind of addresses the Higher Learning Commission's, it's not a suggestion, but it's basically a mandate that teachers of dual credit courses need to hold a master's degree or 18 hours of graduate level course. And so to meet that requirement, my two testifiers have come up with, I think, a pretty, it's a grassroots solution to this. You take the problem out to my part of the state and people can figure it out. And this is what they've done in this case. So I'd like to turn it over to Jeremy, you first.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, welcome. And if you would please, each of you just state your names for the record at the beginning of your testimony.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Jeremy Kovash. I'm the Director of Lakes Country Service Cooperative in West Central Minnesota. Service cooperatives, as you know, were created by state statute in the early 1970s to plan on a regional level, on a regional basis. And I think this is a great example of working with our schools and our members to do so. So our member school superintendents, principals, and other groups meet at our office monthly for professional development, problem solving, and partnership opportunities. We have a long history with our MinSCU partners, who are also members of our cooperative. Minn State Fergus Falls and Minnesota State University Moorhead, in particular, have been tremendous partners in our region. In fact, we recently collaborated with MSUM on a federal Teaching American History grant and several other ongoing professional development partnerships. This fall, as you are all aware, we just heard testimony, the Higher Learning Commission clarified their stance regarding concurrent faculty qualifications. Our school superintendents and principals went to work immediately on a plan to maintain this important program for our communities and our students. I recall calling Dr. Bradbury, who I know and we've worked well together, and asking him to meet to discuss solutions for the Higher Learning Commission clarifications. With our members, we developed the concept of House File 3326, which builds cohorts of 18 online credits in content area for our concurrent high school teachers. In northwestern Minnesota, we have 90 school districts, our region and the region to our north, which is actually the old governor's regions 1, 2, and 4. We have 90 school districts, which is about one-fourth of the state school districts. We have approximately 300 concurrent enrollment teachers teaching these 4,000 students who earn credits in these courses annually. 300 teachers, about 4,000 students annually. They generate about 12,000 credits annually in our regions, these two regions, and save students and their families, by pretty conservative estimates, about $2.4 million annually in college tuition. I believe after the Higher Learning Commission testimony this October, the Star Tribune said a statewide number of $24 million. So 2.4 million makes a little bit of sense. We probably maybe got kind of one-tenth of the population. Originally, our concept was intended to help schools primarily in the broad geographic area of northwestern Minnesota, and our intent was to work with our MinSKU partner to do so. However, as we collected data, we found some economies of scale and size, and we think that we could expand this partnership a little bit. And a good example of that is physics. We have 10 physics teachers in our region that need additional credits, and so it probably doesn't make sense to offer a course with 10 students. That might be right on the borderline, but we think we would take 16 or 18 or work with the college to determine that number. So we would certainly open up slots to the rest of the state, any physics teachers who were able to concurrently or concurrent physics teachers who needed additional credits. Our school leaders have long asked for additional content-specific coursework for their outstanding educators who teach concurrent level courses in high school. Quite honestly, in greater Minnesota and where we're at in western and northwestern Minnesota, those classes have not traditionally been easy to find. Not traditionally easy to find a master's level physics course in northwestern Minnesota. We think this is an ongoing professional solution to solve that problem. So courses such as calculus, English, College U.S. Government, College Biology, and physics, as mentioned, we think this bill will go a long way in solving that problem and make this a continuous program for our students and teachers. Our role as Lakes Country Service Cooperative would be to be the fiscal and program host. We work well with our school districts, we work well with our college partners, and we would administer the program. We would so the funding mechanism is indicated in House File 3326. Really, there are three budget outputs. The first is to assist MSUM in course development, stipends for their higher ed faculty, and support for those faculty as they develop courses and programs of study. The second piece are tuition scholarships paid directly to MSUM so that our teachers will not have to dig into their own pockets to take these courses that they've quite honestly already been teaching for years and years, as we're well aware. $150 per credit is an arranged fee with Minnesota State University Moorhead. Dr. Bradbury will testify to that. $10 of that would go to Lakes Country Service Cooperative to administer the program, to cut checks to MSUM, and the third piece of the program, to provide stipends to teachers who have no financial incentive to attain further credits. So a vast majority, I shouldn't say a vast majority, a majority of these teachers have already, I would call it the southeast corner of the salary schedule, or the very east side of the salary schedule. Most of these teachers who are teaching these courses have already attained a master's plus 45 or a master's plus 30 or all the way over on their salary schedule. So we have developed a program, House File 3326, asked for stipends for those teachers to incent them to continue to teach these important courses for our students. The plan would be for lane advancement first, stipend second. So if a teacher needs lane advancement, that's the skin in the game for the school district. Those teachers would get lane advancements in their respective school district. If they're all the way over on the far right hand side, if they've achieved all the lane advancements in their district, they would receive a stipend for their coursework. This program is a continuous improvement model for our schools that can be replicated throughout Minnesota between our schools and regional MinSKU partners. We're ready to implement this beginning this summer as a pilot project that we think can benefit schools, teachers, and students. And again, we think it's very, very replicable throughout Minnesota. We see only winners with the passage of House File 3326. First, our communities, who will continue to have the propensity to keep our best and brightest students in this state. Many of these students utilize college credits in the high school to earn more advanced degrees or even enter the workforce earlier. We've heard much from parents and folks in our communities and around the state whose students utilizing college credits in the high school often graduated in 3 or 4 years versus 5 or 6. Secondly, MinSKU institutions are winners as well. Institutions such as MSUM or Bemidji State or Mankato State, who will continue to attract our best and brightest students who already have credits that easily transfer into MinSKU institutions. Thirdly, MinSKU concurrent enrollment partners such as M-State Fergus Falls, Southwest State University, who can continue these local, robust partnerships between K-12 and higher education. Fourthly, our school districts, who will not lose students who might otherwise leave high school early. School districts who have built this curriculum with their local communities and have pride in their array of course offerings. In addition, their concurrent teachers, who might already have a master's plus 30 credits, can continue to teach these courses and become better trained, developed, and paid. House File 3326 not only takes care of our current teachers, but would continue to improve education by offering content area courses that are developed today but will last far into the future. Lastly, and most importantly, our best and brightest students. Our top kids generate thousands of credits in our high schools. Again, these credits can save our students conservatively up to $2.4 million annually. These kids play on our athletic teams in our high schools, they participate in fine arts and activities, and they are our school leaders. Let's continue to support them as they become our next generation of leaders in communities in the state of Minnesota. Thank you. Dr. Boyd Bradbury will continue his testimony in support of House File 3326, and I will remain for questions following his remarks.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Boyd Bradbury. I'm the Acting Dean of the College of Education and Human Services at Minnesota State University Moorhead. Mr. Kovash did a very fine job, I think, in summarizing some of the major points and rationale of this particular bill. I'll just add a few thoughts here. Service cooperatives and the MSUM partnership and the potential cost savings to students and members of the community really is quite substantial with House File 3326. With the Higher Learning Commission guidelines regarding faculty, I would like to just address that briefly and expand on that. While this is not a new requirement of what we refer to as the HLC, the Higher Learning Commission, the HLC has made clear its intent now to enforce this policy regarding existing guidelines for faculty qualifications. Current HLC policy states, if a faculty member holds a master's degree or higher in a discipline or subfield other than that in which he or she is teaching, that faculty member should have completed a minimum of 18 graduate credit hours in the discipline or subfield in which they teach. And so there are those 18 credits that Chairwoman Loon has explained. House File 3326 and its companion in the Senate, Senate File 3062, address the HLC requirements regarding faculty qualifications while making this a manageable solution. All partners are invested, as Mr. Kovash mentioned. School districts are responsible for faculty lane change costs. MSU Moorhead is offering a reduced graduate credit rate. Service cooperatives are acting as a mechanism through which this effort can be realized. The net result of this proposed legislation, if passed, is millions of dollars, many millions of dollars of savings for college-bound students and their families. And that those credits that are earned can then be applied toward degrees, and as Mr. Kovash mentioned, oftentimes speeding the process in terms of how quickly students can get through college. MSUM has agreed to offer graduate credit at a significantly reduced rate. Instead of charging our normal graduate credit rate, which is in excess of $400, and those rates are set by the Minsku board, we will charge $150 per credit. This reduced rate is possible because Minsku policy allows universities to modify set tuition rates for market-based and/or continuing education endeavors. Moreover, the collective bargaining agreement to which we must adhere allows for a modified compensation package for instructors under certain circumstances, such as the one that we are proposing here in House File 3326. Under the proposed arrangement, faculty members would be compensated for the development of content-specific courses, so in psychology or chemistry or mathematics, for example, and there would be assistance with the development of these courses so that we know that they're quality online offerings. Departments would have control over the development of these courses so as to assure appropriate content and rigor in these graduate courses. In addition, we would encourage the content professors to consider pedagogical aspects, that would be teaching and learning aspects of these courses in addition to the content. In total, 18 content credits would be offered, and we have consulted with the Office of Higher Education and Minsku Central Office and the IFO, the Interfaculty Organization, regarding this proposal. The final thing that I would mention is that MSU Moorhead is committed to this effort, since we have three strategic anchors at Moorhead, and one of those anchors is being indispensable to the community we serve. Service to approximately 90 school districts, their students, parents, and others would seem to fit the bill as being indispensable to the community. If spaces were available in these courses, and the bill addresses that, then we would be able to open this up potentially to teachers outside of the Northwest Service Cooperative and Lake Service Cooperative regions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mariani, did you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems like a really good opportunity here, and my initial question had to do with, and I know over the years we've constantly struggled back and forth in terms of, you know, whose responsibility is this kind of work? Is it the K-12 finance silo, or is it the higher ed finance silo? I actually have both of the chairs here, so I could ask them to decide that, but the point is that we do have a history and a practice of investing. We just heard from the Q program, which is a higher ed, in terms of private colleges. This would, in some respects, expand that out into a Minscu existence. I'm just wondering very quickly if Mr. Strom might not be able to share with us where else we've got these kind of overlaps with K-12 and post-secondary on future development issues, or is it pretty much this and what we've been doing with Q?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I think your last statement that this and Q are the primary programs where the K-12 committee has overlapped with higher ed on this. There are, Ms. Johnson may be willing to speak about this, but there are budget practices that the House uses that if a program appears to be an entirely higher ed program, even if it started in the K-12 world, that it may transfer into the higher ed budget for future years. And we've got some examples of that over time. But I think the two that you mentioned are probably the primary ones.
Yeah. And so, Madam Chair, you know, obviously we're talking, and I suspect in the Q program as well, you know, K-12 appropriations flowing for higher ed faculty, you know, salaries, et cetera. I think as long as we're real clear about what, you know, and transparent about that, and it's tied to an outcome that kind of, you know, hits where those two, you know, sectors meet, that I think it's fine. I have a feeling that this may be an area we may want to expand even further. I think this is an exciting opportunity that may speak to other parts of the state perhaps following that kind of model using their Minscu system as well. Having said all that, that's going to add up in terms of a big chunk out of the, you know, potentially out of the K-12 finance. And so I just want us to be very thoughtful and mindful as we keep taking those steps forward, you know, what we're committing ourselves to relative to those appropriations. My quick question for the testifier has to do with the report that's required in the bill proposal. And actually, it's probably less a question, but you can certainly respond to it, and more an expectation just from this legislator, particularly in light of the conversation we just had in the previous bill, which is it would be helpful for me to know how effective this kind of effort is, in particular given the growing racial cultural diversity of students that you have in your neck of the woods. You know, so in other words, our concurrent enrollment opportunities have been expanded to include your American Indian, you know, Latino, Asian, you know, African populations. I would just strongly encourage that if we move forward with that, that would be really helpful data points for us to have in light of everything else that we've been talking about in this committee.
Representative, Madam Chair, yeah, I think that's a great point well taken, and probably one that we could work with our school districts to ascertain the percentage of those concurrent enrollment high school students that are students of color. I think that would be, I think we could ascertain and work with our school districts to project that data.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, I understand, you know,
probably the need for funding for scholarships and stipends, but can't you, in collaboration with Morehead State University, develop an online course or develop the hands-on course to be taken? Because after all, it's going to be a revenue source for the colleges or universities. I'm just wondering, to what extent do you need that to develop the curriculum and get the course going? Because I don't think usually we get requests for developing courses at the college level, but we do like to offer scholarships and stipends for those teachers who would need these.
Mr. Kovach?
Representative Erickson, Chair Loon, I think the we are trying to take care of a current problem. So today, a majority of these courses are taught by teachers who have very little financial incentive to continue or go back to school to get 18 additional credits when they've maybe been teaching this class for 20 years in the past. So we realize this is a unique unique request for kind of a trying time. I do agree that and I'll let Representative or Dr. Bradbury answer that, but the intent of Morehead State, Minnesota State University Morehead, is to offer these to solve that kind of regional partnership, but also then to develop a long-standing program so these courses are available. I was a graduate in 1995 in history and taught these courses for several years at Perham High School, and I wanted to go back and get some credits in history or political science, and they were, quite honestly, they were not available at the time. So, Dr. Bradbury.
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative, if I understand the question correctly, in particular, it has to do with payment for development of the course at the post-secondary level. Yes, and that would not be what we normally would do. In this, you're quite right. In this particular case, quite frankly, we don't make a whole lot of money on this at $150, what turns out to be $140 per graduate credit. The compensation rate paid to the instructor is $81 and 25 credits plus fringe, so that's a pretty small markup that's there to deal with some of the overhead and such associated with it. One of the reasons why you likely haven't seen the development of some of the content courses previously is that they're not particularly lucrative for post-secondary institutions. The demand is fairly low. And as a result, when you have low incident type demands, then there's less of an inclination for higher ed institutions to develop those, of course. So with that said, in this particular case, we feel there needs to be a greater incentive for the development of these content courses, and that could come in this form, in some compensation to develop those so that they then could be offered, because some of these will be offered on a limited basis, all of them, and some of them perhaps only once or twice given the low demand that could be there by discipline.
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, do we know how many potential candidates we'd have who would seek out these courses so that they'd have the qualifications to continue teaching the concurrent enrollment courses?
I don't personally have that number, and I don't know if Mr. Strom has any idea how many potential candidates, or Mr. Kovach, do you have any sense from your region of the state?
So we, Representative Loon, Representative Erickson, Chair Loon, we surveyed all of our school districts. So our 90 school districts have submitted their data, and we know that number is approximately 300 teachers in our regions.
Very good.
And those we actually have them broken down by course, so we know we have approximately 65 who need math. We got that all broken down. So we'd be happy to provide any additional information that would be requested.
Madam Chair, that would be very interesting if we could have that data. That's very good.
Be.
Thank you very much.
Thank
That's
you.
Excellent.
Yes, if you would forward that to the committee, we'll make sure that all the members receive it. Thank you very much. Representative Mark Bart, we'll go to you since Representative Mariani's tied up.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nornes, for bringing this forward. I am one of those concurrent teachers that has a master's degree but not in government, and they allowed my professional experience to qualify, so I do teach that. But I wouldn't qualify for the dollars because I think we have, what, 3 or 4 years yet to get into compliance, and I'm probably going to be done by then. So whatever benefits would go to another teacher at DGF. But when that group came out and said that they were no longer going to accredit, it was like a bombshell out in our neck of the woods, because very few, well, as Mr. Kovash mentioned, I mean, there's teachers that have the master's but not specific in those fields, and there's no one offering them. So even there's no way to try to do that. So I appreciate MSUM and others coming forward to do this. And in rural Minnesota, where even though my district deal with Glenfeld, they can go into Moorhead and go PSEO that way. But in many of these rural districts, it's quite a ways for a student to have to travel to a college to get that credit. And it is a huge, huge benefit for students at concurrent enrollment. The students really benefit. The parents love it. The schools benefit. It's just a win-win-win. So I think this is an excellent way to try to address this, to keep this going, and being able to have these teachers that would qualify under this. I forget what the name of the group is that sets that, but so anyway, thank you. I strongly support your efforts.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just kind of picking up a little bit from what I had spoke about earlier. So we have a $3 million request. Sub 4 in Section 1 identifies purposes in terms of funding, and so there's funding for course development work, and so I heard that in terms of potential stipends for faculty, etc. And then 2 is about providing scholarships for eligible students to enroll. My question is, I guess it's for anyone there, is so what's the thinking here in terms of how that $3 million would be spent? Is it $2 million you're thinking for tuition, scholarship support for teachers, or is it $2 million for faculty stipends? And so, just your thinking around this, and then also perhaps to the author, to consider perhaps being a little bit more precise about, based on what we're hearing here, in terms of constructing this language, so that wherever it is the value here is, whether it's the flow, capacity building into higher ed, that we indicate that in terms of the use, or, flowing it into tuition for, access for teachers. I think the worst thing you would want in a year or two or three is to come back and someone to say, you know what, the bulk of that money went to higher ed, and very minimal teachers got were able to access, or even the extreme the other way, that whole bunch of tuition money and then just not great capacity at the higher ed. So, your thoughts about that,
Sir Kovash?
Representative Mariani, Chair Loon. So it's a little tough to put a finger on. And Representative Marquardt, I think so. We have phenomenally accurate data for where we're at today, but today in school districts changes every second. So we have no way to know if Representative Marquardt is going to retire in the next 4-year window. So,
well, you heard it here.
November's results.
So it's a little. So it's a little challenging to do that, but I can say that in general, very little, the dollar amounts for subdivision one there, which is course development, and we've identified that as course development adjunct replacement. So we want to make sure that these classes have rigor, that they go through the higher ed process, that they're approved and high quality classes for our educators. But really, we're not talking a large portion of that of those dollars for staff development to go to Minnesota State University Moorhead. We're talking somewhere between, let's throw out $5,000 per course. Some of this would be depending on the budget that we're able to set, but $5,000 per course that's developed. So if we have 15 courses that are developed, $5,000, you're talking $75,000. A little adjunct replacement, again, someone to work with online teachers to make sure that, again, these courses have rigor standards. So maybe perhaps $25,000 there. So again, you're maybe talking $100,000 out of the $3 million budget. The $150 per credit is a scholarship. Again, that's probably not a lion's share. I think we've kind of preliminary done math. You know, maybe $700,000 or $800,000 there. The vast majority of the dollars, I'll call it two thirds, would go to stipends to those teachers who can't earn lane changes anymore. So the majority of the dollars will, and again, we can try to flesh this out the best we can, but it's a moving target. But you know, a majority of those dollars would go to high school teachers concurrently teaching those courses for those to continue to do that, to incent them to do that.
But
Representative Marianne,
Madam Chair, I certainly don't want to micromanage and you know, construct this bill in a way that makes it unworkable in the real world. And frankly, you have the better knowledge to do that than I. But I think it is important for us to capture what the intent is, right? You know, on the record here as we move the bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, thank you. I listened very carefully to Representative Mariani, and the answers that Representative Erickson received, and I think this is a solution to an issue, to many issues that we've been talking about: the shortage of teachers, the how a teacher that has been working for 20 years can be newly inspired. And in a way, again, maybe this is a historical bill in the sense that we're talking about the higher education institution has come down on their prices and is willing to work with the solution with K-12 on a problem for a region, and they could be a model for other service districts in the state and plow the field, so to speak. And my gosh, talking about paying the teacher's tuition or after they've attained their master's to get a stipend for doing something that will help them and the students that are to come about and to go through this program and planting the seeds in the fields that we've just plowed is almost unprecedented. If we think to a year ago at this time, when we were talking about that Mankato project and teaching principals how to be principals and teaching superintendents how to be superintendents, that was in another program. And it was just taken for granted that all the costs of those programs would be paid for, and not by the principal or the superintendent, but by the school district or the state. And in this bill, Representative Nornes, that you brought to us, we're talking about some of those same things coming to the teacher, the person that's closest to the students in all learning. I say go for it.
And on that note, Representative Nornes, we'll renew your motion to send this to higher ed and give you the final comments.
No, I thank you very much for the time. And again, I'm proud to be here representing not only this bill, but these guys that have worked so hard to put it together. They came a long days. They came from Fergus and they came from Moorhead just to be with us. That's pretty special.
And thank you for coming, and safe travels. And with that, the chair renews the motion to move the bill to, or re-refer this to higher ed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? You're on your way. And with that, Representative Swinzinski, if you would move your bill, or bring your bill up, House File 3427. And on your way up here, the chair will move the bill with the intent to refer to Ways and Means with the intent to lay it over. And if that, Representative Swinzinski, if you'd like to open up with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee. It's been a great busy week here, and House File 3427 really is a bill focusing at local needs within southwest Minnesota. We've got some interesting prospects of developing a program to really take paraprofessionals who are folks that are working in the school districts already, but also integrate them into the issues of licensure, because we have a lot of rural school districts that are having a tough time finding folks with the skill sets that they need to deal with the new licenses that are coming about. And I have Rhonda Bonsetha. Sorry, to come testify on behalf of the bill, and appreciate the opportunity. Come on up.
And thank you, Ms. Bonsetter. And I apologize, but I have to ask you to keep your comments very high level and brief. I have a long list of testifiers for the bill, so.
Absolutely happy
thank
to
you.
Do so.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks.
And please state your name for the record.
Rhonda Bonsetter. I'm a professor of education at Southwest Minnesota State University. I'm here to talk to you today about House File 3427. What this initiative would do would provide funding to get a program off the ground that would allow paraprofessionals to move into the role of special education teaching through Southwest Minnesota State University. The program came about, as I've heard before, there's a huge shortage of special ed teachers in particular, and especially in our greater Minnesota areas. Very hard to find teachers who are willing to move to greater Minnesota to teach in that area. And so we've been working with our local Southwest West Central Service Cooperative, with Cliff Carmody and Mary Palmer there, as they've been asking us, who have you got? And they're looking at community experts, at people still in the training programs to fill positions that are available. And so we started trying to see, well, what could we do with this? And they had a number of paraprofessionals who worked with the service cooperative talk to them about the possibility of moving on to get their licensure in special education. But there are a number of barriers to them for that. And in particular, most of these paraprofessionals can't afford to quit their position in order to travel to school. I, at one point, was one of these paraprofessionals. I live about 35 miles south of Marshall. My husband farms. I was working as a para in our local school district and was encouraged by them to go on and get my secondary math degree because they needed a math teacher in their district. And I was able to do so only because I was just close enough to Marshall at 35 miles each way to, drop my kids on the bus at 7 in the morning, drive to Marshall, attend classes for half of the day, get back to Marshall to Slayton in time to work as a para from 12:30 to 4:30 each day, and then go home to the husband and four kids. Most of these teachers, the paraprofessionals, don't have that luxury. They're much farther away. They can't afford to have their schedules worked out, as my district was willing to do, to make this possible. They need to continue working while they are going through the teacher education program. We currently have an approved special education academic behavioral strategist program at Southwest Minnesota State University. We've identified through the service cooperative that there are over 50 paraprofessionals through a survey they did who are already interested in starting this program. The funding that we're looking for would be just the initial start of funding to have the instructor that we would need to hire and some adjunct faculty to offer the program for the first 2 years so that after that the tuition would allow it to be self-funding. So we believe there's an ongoing role for looking for these paraprofessionals and getting them into the program. I can tell you, in working in area schools, many of these paraprofessionals are people of color who would very much like to get into teaching, but again, they don't have a pathway at this point. They can't stop working in order to enroll in a program to travel to school. So this would allow them to continue working, obtain their degree, and provide our districts with much needed talent in the field of special education from people who are already in that classroom. They know what they're getting into. These people know the field of special education, know these students, and are passionate about working with them. So if you have any questions, that's the real short version.
Great. And thank you. And do we have any questions? Not seeing any from the members. Anybody from the public? And with that, thank you very much. Representative Swinzinski, if you'd like to make final remarks.
Thank you, Chair Kreisha. I appreciate the opportunity. I think this is really a model when it comes to higher education, when it comes to SMSU, when it comes to our schools of higher learning. Being regionally significant is an integral part of that.
being agile, and I think this really speaks to the fact of what we need higher education to be able to do, is look at the needs of the community, see it change, and make it happen to keep folks in our rural areas. So appreciate the opportunity to be in front of the committee. Thank you, Chair Crecia.
And thank you. And with that, the Chair renews the motion to refer to Ways and Means with the Chair's intention to lay the bill over. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to... And with that, we have a number of testifiers that have traveled here. And Representative Erickson, we'd like to take the following testifiers of your bill, and then I think we'll lay it over, but we want to hear these testifiers first. Ms. Beth Geese, Mr. Troy Hauger, Ms. Jessica Duder, Ms. Heidi Derricks, and Mr. Peter Widenbach. So if all of you would come up, and two of you at the testifier stand at a time, and then the rest of you just be prepared to be behind, but I want to make sure the committee is able to hear from all of you. So with that, Ms. Geese. Okay, hop up there, tell me your name, and we'll cross you off as we go. And if the second person would come on up and be ready to go right away, that'd be great. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Troy Haugen. I'm the Career and Technical Education Coordinator at Lakes Country Service Cooperative out of Fergus Falls. We've got quite a Lakes Country representation here today, as you heard from my boss, Mr. Kovash, a little while ago. I administer the Perkins Grant for 26 school districts in our region of Economic Development Region 4. My largest district is Moorhead, with a significant number of graduates for our area, and my smallest district is Campbell Tinta, who graduates between 8 and 10 kids a year. I've been in education for 20 years, starting as a teacher and an administrator, and in the last three I've been in this role. In 3 years, we've had a significant number of increases in variances in career and technical education. We went from 1 3 years ago to have 5 teachers on variances right now. We have increasing the number of community experts. We have 3 ag teachers that have left to go to business and industry. And frankly, I'm becoming reluctant to even tie my teachers to business and industry internships because they steal them. We have lost 3 business education programs, 2 construction careers programs, not because of lack of funding, but because of lack of teachers. We've had to close programs in our region because we don't have teachers. And approximately 2/3 of my CTE teachers in my region are likely to retire within the next 5 years. We have a perfect storm happening right now. We have an aging population. We have a convoluted licensure system. We have a lack of teacher prep programs, particularly in career and technical education. You cannot get a construction careers or manufacturing careers, transportation careers, health careers license in Minnesota. There is no college prep coursework in Minnesota for those licenses. And we have a competing agile business and industry sector that's stealing our teachers, frankly. I applaud Representative Erickson for addressing this head on. And frankly, this issue keeps me up at night because I have 4 kids of my own. Not that keeps me up with 4 kids, too, but I don't know who's going to teach my kids. I'm afraid who's going to teach my kids. There's no pipeline, and I'm afraid we're going down a bad path. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your time.
And thank you, Mr. Haugen, and we're going to hold the questions to the end. The next testifier.
Okay, now after I ran a flight of stairs.
You're doing great.
I'm Superintendent Geese of Cannon Falls Schools. Thank you for having us here today. For the last 5 years, I've been working in rural Minnesota. Today, I'm here to stress to you the importance of fixing the teacher shortage program in all of southern Minnesota. Even 6 to 10 years ago, when we posted an elementary teaching position, I would have easily have had 90 to 100 applicants. With the addition of all-day, everyday kindergarten, even in the areas that were abundant, we no longer have the number of candidates that we once had. Special education is by far one of our biggest concerns. I currently have a high school EBD position open right now, and I have 0 applicants. Why is that the case? If you want to reference my slides, I think they passed those out to you. Mm-hmm. It'll have a brown edge around the outside. Thank you. Look at slide number 4. It's from the University of Minnesota. One of our largest institutions simply does not have a special education program, and you can see how it dramatically dropped off in the teaching graduates each year. You see, in the year 2014, there's only 72 graduates in elementary education. The next slide, on slide 5, is the Minnesota State University out of Mankato. You will notice at this institution, we have an increase in high school teachers, but again, no special education graduates or any early childhood graduates. And finally, I'll reference slide number 6, the University of Wisconsin-Stout. This university is known for their teaching programs, and in 2014, they graduated a total of 98 teachers. And of those 98, only half will actually go into teaching, and another half of those will not complete 5 years of teaching. I think there is hope. I think that House File 3132 attempts to look at the teaching shortage and address some of the key factors that are preventing us from having highly qualified teachers in the classroom. We need to require that higher education have at least one program in the state for any of the required of licensure. For example, there are no programs in the area of vision. None. We need to make academic and behavioral strategists, the ABS license that you've heard about, a standalone renewable license. Require higher education to have all licensure areas at a BA level. Create a clear pathway for teacher licensures from other states. We need to look at paid internships. Many young adults pass on the opportunity to teach because of possibly not being able to work the entire school year. It's simply not a possibility if you're a young adult with a family. Many other occupations get paid. Doctors get paid to do a residency. Internships, carpenters, plumbers, all of them do some sort of journeyman or internship. We need to create tuition assistant and loan forgiveness programs, which is a part of this bill. And lastly, we need to eliminate the hurdles to licensure. We are not asking anyone to make it easy to become a teacher. It should be one of the most rigorous degrees that you can obtain. However, the Board of Teaching makes it almost impossible to transfer a license from another state, especially with all of these shortages. When I moved here from Nebraska, I let all of my special education licensures expire because the portfolio the Board of Teaching required is outdated and a tremendous amount of work. In February, I presented to the Region 1 legislative session. I have made those copies available to you. So if you have any questions on those, I know Plum and a few others were there for that.
And thank you for making you. I actually let you go on a little long because go big red.
What's that?
Go big red.
Oh, thank you. Go Huskers.
Those of you who don't get that.
Yeah, it's okay.
Thank you very much. The next test fire and. I am down to about 6 minutes, so you guys are doing great, the test fires and gals. If you can keep this to a minute, awesome.
All right. Mr. Chair, my name is Heidi Dierks, and I'm a first grade teacher at Casa Manorville Elementary School. We're here today to speak about fair and equitable funding for the teacher development and evaluation law. My colleague that was going to speak first had to leave. She's one of three instructional leaders in our district. Part of this position includes implementing the teacher development and evaluation plan. Her role includes helping teachers set their professional growth goals, coordinate their peer reviews, providing feedback for the peer review and portfolio year teachers, and analyzing and measuring data. This position was created in part to comply with the teacher development and evaluation law, but the district receives no additional funding to support it. And I just want to also share a quick example with you of my experience with the teacher evaluation plan. I just received an email yesterday reminding me that I need to complete my second year peer observation for this school year, and I have not completed it yet as we are having difficulty paying for subs to cover our classrooms when doing our observations or having follow-up conversations afterwards, as our district doesn't have the funds to support that. So we urge you to support fair funding for teacher development, the teacher development and evaluation law. Thank you.
And thank you very much. Yeah. And the next test fire. You state your name for the record. And
Mr. Chair, my name is Pete Wietenbach. I'm a 8th grade teacher at Casa Manorville Middle School. Thank you guys for your time. I'll keep it short and sweet. CAM, we're not a QCOMP school district. We're one of over 250 districts that are not. Therefore, we don't receive those financial benefits of a QCOMP district. I just want to remind you that teachers, like many professions, We are eager to learn. We are happy to learn. We're willing to learn. We want to improve our classrooms. We want to be better. We want to be the best we can be to provide the best education for our students. One of the best ways that we can achieve that is through these observations and being able to meet with our colleagues and our peers to improve our classrooms. In 2011, we asked for your help in creating that evaluation and observation, and you helped us, and we thank you for that. And now we're asking you, and we urge you to financially support the TD&E program. Thank you.
And thank you. And I apologize. Yeah, great job, testifiers. We're going to be hearing this bill further, so at this point, I'm going to lay this bill over. Thank you very much for your time, and safe travels back. I'm going to now ask for the teachers for House File 3340 to come forward so we can get your testimony in. And in the meantime, Representative Bennett, if you could tell me if you'd like to move the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I do move the minutes.
And with that, all those in favor of the minutes, unless there's any questions, say aye.
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 All those opposed? And with that, to the testifier, if you would state your name, just one.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Loon, members of the committee. My name is Kalina Tapu. I'm a member of E4E, Educators for Excellence. And I'm here to testify on House File 3340, which you'll hear more about later. But I wanted to share why I'm in support of this bill. In my final years of high school, I considered many career paths, but never considered education. But I had an interest in mathematics and an awareness of my potential as a female of color. I decided to pursue industrial engineering for a bachelor's degree and master's degree. And I was also asked during my graduate studies to tutor at a local high school. And that was where I really realized where I had power as a female of color. I knew that I'd be an amazing educator, but I was never a quitter, so I decided to finish my master's in industrial engineering. So after all those years of college and tuition, I very well may not have been a teacher if I had not had the opportunity to earn my teaching degree through an alternative teaching certification program called the Twin Cities Teaching Fellows. I forever count myself blessed that I was able to be a part of this program that was defunded after only two cohorts. As a passionate and dedicated teacher, I have felt the love and gratitude from many of my students. However, the number of students of color who have thanked me for being a teacher is astounding. They know that it's hard work for me to consistently be the only teacher of color in our school. And they know that that it's difficult work for me. In Minnesota, our students of color experience marginalization at a level experienced by few elsewhere. The achievement and discipline outcomes for students of color are worse in Minnesota than in almost all other states. The outcomes are due to daily experiences of our students of color, the feelings that they have as they walk into classroom after classroom, feeling misunderstood or misjudged according to the stereotypes, particularly prevalent in the Midwest. If we continue with an education system that does not fully serve all of our students, is it fair that we expect students of color to have positive experiences? Is it fair that we expect them to fully support their children in that same system years later? Certainly, it is not fair for us to expect them to come back and be educators in that same system. And without teachers of color, our students will never see themselves as a part of our school communities. It's a cycle that needs to be stopped. We cannot quickly increase education and discipline outcomes for our students of color, but we can start to put more teachers of color in our schools. It's fortuitous that alternative teaching programs not only attract teachers of color, but also teachers who have rich backgrounds in other fields that greatly enhance their classrooms. So please show your support for House Bill 3340.
And thank you. And what was the last name again? So I pronounced that correctly?
Atapu.
Atapu.
Yeah.
Members, any questions for Ms. Atapu? Thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, if there's any other teachers for House File 2805 or 3340 that would like to come up, we can certainly hear your testimony if you can't come back tomorrow. Okay. Looks like just one. Hello? And if you state your name.
Sir,
Professor Deborah Dillon is available for questions that I can't answer, but I'm the only resident today.
Okay. Did you have testimony for us then?
I do.
Okay, and then what I'm going to have you have you state your name for the record and tell me which bill you want to testify to, and then go ahead and go into your remarks.
Mr. Chair, he's testifying to my bill.
Okay.
So my name is Joseph. My name is Joseph Bluthorn.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's on us, not you. Go ahead.
I'm Joseph Bluthorn, and I am a resident with a Minneapolis residency program, might be referred to or also known as Grow Your Own. And I'm here to just try to give you very briefly, and I know there's not much time, an overview of how this program works and why tuition support is important for the residents in this program, for the cohort coming after mine. My cohort is the first. This is my third attempt to get a license via an alternative pathway, and I wanted to stress that this one has some features that make it particularly effective. One of those, or most importantly, is it does a really good job of eliminating or reducing the barriers to people who are already adults, who are already post-baccalaureate, trying to continue on and get licensure. And I think you've heard actually quite a bit of testimony from programs that are similar to this, so I won't belabor that, except to say that this has really strong academic support while you are involved in this process, really strong social emotional support, which is not a trivial thing when you are with kids 4 days a week and then all day long you're in classes. So your weekends and your evenings and your mornings, which are not with kids, you're doing all the other things that are involved in this 15-month licensure program. But also it provides, reduces or helps you navigate anyway, the really substantial bureaucratic barriers that are involved in licensure in this state. And again, I won't belabor what those barriers are. You've heard other testimony previously that kind of address those. Some of those have to do with the way that our teacher prep programs are set up at the University of Minnesota, Minscule, and other places. Some of that has to do with the Minnesota Department of Education. Some of that has to do with the Board of Teaching. But again, I won't belabor that. I want to stress that this is a really rigorous program. The people that are involved in our training are both academically and practically prepared to prepare us. They are professors and associate professors. They are masters and doctoral level people, but they're also always people who themselves have years of classroom experience as teachers. So we have a great deal of support in taking these theoretical constructs and turning them into concrete strategies in the classroom. The issue with tuition support, you've probably heard or you may be made aware that the University of Minnesota reduced tuition for this program from $24,000 to $15,000, and that's hugely helpful. But even $15,000 can be a heavy lift when you consider that the people in this program are definitely not in the 1%. These are young folks who many of them are struggling to deal with the debt that they've incurred to get that bachelor's degree that they have, that you have to be in this program. Some of these folks are young families where both parents are working. Sometimes maybe there's more than two jobs that they're holding down to be able to support themselves and their families. There's also the issue that paraprofessionals, these are the people that were brought into this program, often are not making the kind of money where they can have substantial savings or a nest egg that they can draw down to use to help them deal with that tuition. So at that point, if you have any questions for me, I've pretty much said my 2 cents worth.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the concise remarks. With that, members, if you have any questions, I can take one. Otherwise, at this point, we're going to run out of time. Seeing no questions, so members, tomorrow we'll be adding to the agenda House File 2805, House File 3340, House File 3132, House File 3166. And with that, to the public and the testifiers, thank you very much for your patience with us, and this meeting is adjourned.